tape 15, side 31. In today's New York Times, Thomas Friedman talks about Israel, and actually the subject is put up, shut up, or hang up. And the issue is, at some point, that Netanyahu, in order to, that Arafat's inability to deal with democracy, and Netanyahu evidently doing what is internal politics, there doesn't seem to be any point. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any agreement at this point, and the hopes of peace are just diminishing and diminishing. I'm just curious what your opinion is on what Netanyahu is doing.
Well, there's an external and internal element to Netanyahu. On the external side, I don't think he cares, and probably nobody else cares either, whether the Palestinians are democratic or not. If none of the other countries in the Near East are really democratic, so if they are peaceful with Israel, as Hussein, I suppose you could call that a semi-democracy, although many of these countries are in that state, that's their internal governance is of no concern, really, to us. It may be of concern to us as Americans, but not to the Israelis. His policy, will it keep peace from happening? Well, I guess it's a yes and no proposition, because I'm not convinced that we're going to have peace, a real peace in the Middle East, the kind that we know between the United States and Canada, or the United States and Mexico, ever. The countries are too unstable. If you negotiate one year, and you'll have a different set of rulers the next year. So whatever happens, I think, will be on a temporary basis, and whatever is more permanent is probably going to be more on an economic basis. That if the economies are meshed better, it'll lead to at least more peaceful conduct. Internally, a lot of Israelis are unhappy and continue to be unhappy about the power that the 12 or 15% of the Orthodox have as the swing vote. And of course, that's an outcome of too much democracy, that by having proportional representation, you give a lot of power to this swing group. Now here, if you win a seat by 5 votes, you're in, the other folks are out. And it's very simple. It may reverse the next time. So I don't know whether that's not going to be easy to change. In fact, it's impossible to change under the present circumstances. So the problem there is, I think, twofold. One is the religious problem and the religious and cultural conflict, which is worsening as the external situation improves. And the second is the ultimate danger of somebody getting tired of this form of democracy and in some crisis taking over.
Do you have anyone in mind? I mean, is there any person? Or
No. This is a hypothetical
situation.
Do you think
the 12% could possibly...
What?
The fundamentalists maybe take over?
Oh, no. That's not what I'm thinking at all, is that if there's a real stalemate, some military group or a small ruling clique will simply step in with the approval of the electorate, because they'll be disgusted by an endless stalemate.
You mentioned the economics, so isn't that basically today, in today's world, I mean, even Syria is thinking of coming around a little bit, because economically, how long can this go on? I mean, how long can you spend the kind of money? I mean, isn't basically economics the whole big picture?
No.
In order for them to function?
You know, I just visited Burma. Burma has been isolated for 50 years. So it's possible for 50 years. That's a long time.
But not once the people there, isolation for 50 years, fine, but people know. I mean, the communication, look what's happened in Iran. People, you can't isolate people the way you used to be able to. Young people know what's going on. This is what's happened in Iran, I think.
Well, it's a long way from knowing and being willing to take the risk to move. A regime that wants to be oppressive has the tools to do that.
And then you have to mobilize, so you feel that the people will move with it because of their being disgusted.
I don't know that they will. They haven't in Syria.
So, we were talking about...
So it's perfectly possible for an oppressive regime to continue for a very long period of time, even with all the modern technologies, and I think we've seen enough examples of that around the world.
It's not a very optimistic picture, is it? Or is it realistic?
Well, I think we've got what's close to a peace in the Near East, and there'll be a certain number of casualties every year, and a bus will blow up. If you're on it, it's very sad. But otherwise, I think people simply say, well, how many people are killed in automobile accidents per year? So this is a relatively small price. How much would it cost us if we mobilized and sent military in? You know, how many hundreds of casualties would we have?
You mean the UN forces, or?
No, I'm talking about Israelis.
Oh.
You
speak of we, and so you feel that you're we?
No. I'm just putting this into the mouth of the Israelis.
Okay.
So this may be as much as they're going to get in the foreseeable future, with or without a treaty. You know, whether you can quiet the Hamas. There'll be others. If the Iranians don't back them, Sudanese may back them. Soon, who knows, the people in Afghanistan may have enough money to back somebody else.
You have a major Islamic movement, a fast growing.
So I don't think there's going to be the kind of peace that we speak of, which exists in Central Europe and North America.
Walter, all that we've asked you, and you know, we go through some very chronological order of events with your family, neither Gabi and I feel that you have talked about each of your sons' bar mitzvah, where they had their training, and...
Well, see, what you have to understand is that in this household, a rabbinic household, a bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah does not loom as large as it would elsewhere. I'm interested in the total life and the total education of the children, and it's a continuous process, and the bar mitzvah is a nice and happy event, but it's not that kind of a enormous high point. And that's why I haven't made a big fuss about it, and that's why we also didn't make that big a fuss about it when it occurred. You know, we had a simple reception. In fact, kept it extra simple to show that it's possible to have a bar mitzvah without having a tremendous festivity.
How about a safari?
So I think that plays a role in. Sure, we had a party for the kids. They had a nice time. We did the same thing again, Irene and I, for a confirmation.
And they were both actually bar mitzvahed here at Rotor. And were you the Kenny rabbi? Or?
Sure.
Okay. And you blessed them both?
Of course. Yes. But you see, it's part of a continuum. I think much more than it would be with at least not all other families, but a lot of other families.
Where the this is just a part of the education, a part of the growing process.
Yes, and their Jewish life went on after Bar Mitzvah and after confirmation just as it did before.
Okay. But it was still a milepost.
Yes, but not, you know, not
I know.
Such a giant thing which everybody kind of looks at that and then afterwards everything sort of rapidly slides down.
So that, okay, this is a continuum kind of thing instead of now that we're Bar Mitzvah, this is the end of going to Sunday school. I heard once Dr. Freehoff mentioned that the reason he was for confirmation is because he felt that it would extend Jewish education further. That was one of his rationales for not doing Bar Mitzvah. Excuse me, I'm sorry, Bobby. I'd like you also tell us about your father's retirement. Mm-hmm. Did it start in Pittsburgh or did he start earlier?
No, retired in Springfield, not from the congregation, because that wasn't all that demanding, but from teaching at the college, and did it gradually, so that he simply taught fewer courses.
And how old was he when he retired?
I think he started the process when he was 65, and then continued slowly to sort of diminish his duties and to tell them that he would be gone for longer periods.
And what did he do during those longer periods when he was gone?
He traveled.
And
my mother.
Just for pleasure or combining it the way you and Reedy are doing now?
It was more for pleasure, and pleasure, seeing family, and partly also to try to stimulate some interest in publishing some of my grandfather's works.
And then they came to Pittsburgh?
Yes.
In what year?
What year did they come to Pittsburgh? I think it was 67.
And then was he still then just traveling, or did he pursue anything new here, or was it just coming here to
Well, he was writing. In all those years, he was doing some writing, but he had more time to do that after his retirement, and worked especially hard for a few of those years. We did that together on a translation of an abridged version of the Genesis commentary of my grandfather. And Ben wrote a variety of essays, number of different topics.
Is it because the opportunities weren't the same, or because he didn't want to have an active of a retirement as you? Was that his choice, or was it just not as available as it is to you?
Well, I think it's more a difference in personality. That, these things that I'm doing with the Institute for Progressive Halakha and the Associated American Jewish Museum, that's purely my doing. Books, he worked on books, but otherwise I don't think he was interested in taking up that kind of thing. And Germany, at that point, was not, there was nothing to be done there because the population was too small. There
at
were
that point.
Maybe 15,000 or 18,000 Jews in all of Germany.
Now we have 100,000. Mm-hmm. Walter, you talked about the fact that you were going on a cruise. This is what's so amazing. That's why I don't think you'll be able to get rid of us, because everything you talk about is in progress. Okay. tell us about that cruise that you went on with Rainey for during the Passover. Tell us where you went and what it was like.
Well, it was an interesting adventure. I don't know that we'll do it so soon again. First of all, it was an opportunity to visit the Far East again. So we spent 2 weeks before the cruise in Burma, Myanmar, more correctly, simply traveled there on our own. There are very few tourists, almost none, absolutely no Americans. Everybody who was there was either in a tour group or in tow. In other words, there was a Burmese who was leading them around. We were the only other people whom we met who were totally alone. It was a young English couple who were doing this on very little, maybe $5 a day.
Oh, my.
And it's possible, especially in a country like Burma. Use of public transportation, to find nice or decent non-air conditioned hotels, which is not too easy, must not be too easy, because it was 100 degrees every day and the humidity was about 90%. But it was fascinating. The people are extremely friendly. They go out of their way to be helpful. The sites, the people are of course very poor, and not hungry though, and decently clothed, and you don't have what you often associate with poverty, you know, that the villages are going to smell terribly or so. They do not. Everybody is remarkably clean, particularly.
So the sanitation is good.
I don't know exactly how that works, because in the cities they of course have sewer systems and so on, but we spend most of the time out in the country. And in these villages the water comes by ox cart, and it's from the Irrawaddy River, so it's not exactly purified. In fact, it's muddy. So what you have to do to stay clean and to keep the place clean must be considerable. And we wandered around, and people were very willing to have us there. And they didn't feel it was an intrusion. The sites are marvelous, because you have an old civilization which goes back 2,000 years with wonderful present-day pagodas. Because the people are Buddhists, almost all of them. Can't say almost all of them, perhaps 85%, 50% or so are Muslim. The ruins of these pagodas in the central part of Burma are magnificent. In Pagan, there are, I think, 3,000. It was once a huge city. The wooden buildings have, of course, all disappeared. But these are built out of brick and stone, and so they remain. The Buddhism is very sincere, and they are very religious people. So if you go to the great shrines, we started off real early in the morning. You know, by 5:30, 6 o'clock, we were well on the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so we would, for example, in Mandalay, we went up to a pagoda, climb up maybe a mile and a half or so, barefoot, of course. Real early, but there were no tourists, but there were lots and lots of Burmese who were going to worship meditating there. Its worship is completely individual, non-congregational. But there are thousands of individuals involved. And there are lots of people who are monks all over the country, male and female.
Female monks?
Yes. Well, they're nuns, I guess. And you can be a monk for any length of time. Most people are a monk for only a short period, half a year, 3 or 4 months. We met one who was a monk for a month, another one who was a monk for only a week.
Why is that?
Because he did this when he was in his late teenage years, and as a monk, you only eat one meal a day.
Okay.
And
he
couldn't take that.
Okay.
But we saw a very large monastery where this was, again in Mandalay, where perhaps 3,000 or 4,000 monks lived. And we were taken around and saw the facilities. Very nice.
Were you there in any official way? You were just a tourist? You didn't tell them who you were, what you were?
Just
you said you
tourist.
Were taken around. What?
Well, you need some method of transportation. So either you hire yourself a taxi or you get yourself a bicycle rickshaw and somebody takes you around. In some places you can walk, but often the distances are too great for that. And you can get you can rent a car for maybe $30 a day for the whole day with a driver and probably somebody else who's coming along for the ride, a friend of the driver.
That's what you did.
And we went way out in the country with these folks and saw gardens or remnants of gardens from the British days up in the mountains. It was fascinating. It is a military dictatorship, which is harsh if you step out of line politically. If you are apolitical or just not involved, they won't bother you. The military, there is no military presence that you feel. You don't see any soldiers. We didn't even see any police. On the street or anywhere else. While we were there, we thought for a while we'd make contact. The woman who has been given the Nobel Prize, I believe, is under house arrest, but on Sunday afternoon you could go visit her. But while we were in Yangon, former Rangoon, the capital, a letter bomb went off, sent to one of the generals, killed one of his daughters.
Wasn't there some talk that she should not accept the award?
But that has nothing to do with it.
Ah, okay.
So we decided that we would not go to see her because we really did. That wasn't the time to go see a dissident. There was a little more military presence after that. There were some roadblocks in which they stopped, not everybody by any means, maybe 10% of the cars. And there certainly is a military presence in a big city like that. You walk by compounds where there are lots of soldiers where there is the necessary armament if you needed it. But none of that was ever out on the street. The other thing we found interesting about the Burmese was we never saw anybody fight or even raise their voice.
Is that part of the Buddhist, or what is it?
It may very well be. So that they were very gentle and kind to each other. And we wandered, all over the place by ourselves, including into some shanty towns. And again, nobody bothered us. Hustled us. We felt completely safe. By the way, the hotels are wonderful and empty and unknown because they're all brand new, so they don't even appear in the tour books. We had no idea where we were going to stay because we had no reservations. We just went COVID. After a bit of an adventure in Yangon, found a nice hotel, because we had the name of a hotel which proved not to exist. So after that, our the taxi that took us from the airport, for which, of course, we had to bargain, drove us around for a while. But the country is freeing up. There is lots of enterprise with European companies, always, of course, involving a general. But the propaganda is still fairly heavy-handed, too. Even in English, it's funny, they have signs, which obviously are intended for us, because the Burmese have not only their own language, but their own alphabet, so you really can't read anything. Which talk about the 4 points, or the 5 things to avoid, including foreign stooges who may upset the government, or something like that. There is a English language newspaper published in the capital, which has local news, almost exclusively, some international news. And on the back page of that, it reminded me of the Jewish Chronicle, because you have pictures of dignitaries, they are in uniform, sitting like we are here. You know, there you are, there are the African violets, and there's a picture. And then the same thing appears again, right next to it, with 2 other characters, you know, who are 2 other women or 2 other men who are seated there. You have a whole back a page of those pictures, very much like the Jewish Chronicle.
Faces change.
Yes. Ceremonial occasions recorded for posterity.
How long did you stay there?
We spent 2 weeks. It was very nice, and it also shows us what difference perceptions make, or where you come from. When we arrived in Bangkok, we stayed overnight in Bangkok, and then wandered around the city a little bit before leaving for Yangon. Bangkok looked very Eastern, Oriental. When we arrived back from Yangon to Bangkok, Bangkok looked very Western.
It's all relative, isn't it?
Yangon is Rangoon.
Yes. We're up to now,
yeah.
There are now some big buildings going up. No building was higher than 5 floors. I mean, you really feel that you're walking down a street of the 50s. Well, it could have been Manila when I was there in the 50s.
Now, the city where there were 3,000 pagodas.
Pagan, P-A-G-A-N.
And do you know, of course I can look it up, the name of the woman who won the
Nobel Prize.
Well, I
won't get it right.
I know, neither will I. I'll look it up. Thank
Have
you.
There been changes since the publicity that her prize winning? I mean, it was tremendous publicity.
Not there.
It wasn't there, okay. All right, okay.
I mean, they can, in the hotels you can get CNN and the Indian, the Star Network, and the Australian News Network. So you have some access to the outside world. By the way, CNN is just terrible. Watching cable in those hotels and other hotels in Bangkok and so on convinced me that there's absolutely no need to get cable.
Why do you think CNN is so terrible?
It's just boring. The same thing over and over again. You see the same pictures over and over again.
Isn't that what it's supposed to be, that people go?
Boring, I suppose so.
No, they're giving information half hour, I think that's basically.
Well,
all
same
they
information.
Expect. Yeah, well, it's like morning news. Morning news. I think you get the weather 5 times or something in 2 hours.
The Indians were far more interesting. I mean, not that I was that concerned about Indian politics, but it was done much better.
So you don't think CNN has any validity for giving information worldwide and connecting people a little bit and informing people and leaders communicating when they know when they couldn't possibly or wouldn't communicate?
Well, I don't think it has anything to do with leaders communicating.
You don't think that the Gulf War, those communications?
In a crisis, that may be used as a medium if somebody is in there, but otherwise, it's not much better than the 11 o'clock news. And that isn't saying much.
In your opinion, right? Okay. Who invited you? We haven't gotten to your Seder yet, but how were you? Who invited you to the Seder?
This whole venture was really built around, they needed a rabbi on this cruise ship. This is the Silver Seas Cruise Line, which is a super deluxe cruise outfit. The ship had only 220 passengers on it. 15,000 ton ship. A crew of about 220 also. Not to run the ship. It only takes 10 people to run the ship. The others were personnel to help us.
Serve you.
Yes. Every cabin